This is Digital Story Podcast number 693, June 25th, 2019. Today's theme is 5 things that I like about the Panasonic G95 and 2 that I don't. I'm Derek Story. When I first picked up the Panasonic G95, I loved the way it felt in my right hand. The grip is substantial, the body light, and my lenses bounce nicely on the camera. And there's a lot beneath the surface to appreciate as well. So today, I share my 5 favorite features and a couple of complaints. I hope you enjoy the show. It's interesting, even though Olympus and Panasonic share the same Micro Four Thirds mount, they tend to be very different cameras. Olympus favors supremely flexible, if not at times confusing, operating systems housed in their classic design aesthetic. Panasonic, on the other hand, sports a more modern look and prides itself in being both still photography and video capable. In that sense, the G95 is the archetypal Panasonic Micro Four Thirds camera. Why is that? Well, because it has an excellent set of still photography features, and at the same time, it is clearly a video powerhouse. So let's take a look at its basic specs, and then we'll get into the 5 things that I really like and a couple that I don't, all right? So starting out with the basic stuff, what kind of camera are we looking at here? We're looking at a 20.3 megapixel Micro Four Thirds camera. So it has a Micro Four Thirds sensor on there. That means if you put a 12 millimeter lens on there, it has an effective view of 24 millimeters because it has the 2x crop. It has 4K 30p video with no time limits. In other words, it'll just keep going in 4K until the card fills up. And it has pre-installed Vlog L gamma profile, 8-bit only. And this is something that sometimes Panasonic charges extra for, but it's included in the camera. And this is part of its argument that is the ultimate hybrid camera with excellent video as well as stills. It has a 5-axis sensor stabilization, dual IS2. I just tested it in the field with both Olympus lens and Panasonic lenses, and some had image stabilization, optical image stabilization, and some didn't. No matter what lens I put on there, it worked well and the images were sharp. So that's kind of the bottom line on that. It has a 2.36 million dot OLED viewfinder, and the viewfinder is quite nice and a pleasure to look through. And it has a 3-inch 1.24 million dot free angle touchscreen. In other words, it's a very angled touchscreen. You can pull it, swing it out to the side, angle it all different directions. Really handy when you're shooting video. And also, it comes in handy when you're shooting still photography as well. It has an AF system, a DFD AF system that has 49 areas, which is not bad at all. And the autofocusing I thought was interesting because you have, all these different patterns and so forth that you can choose. And at first it was a little confusing to me. I was trying to get the autofocus set up the way that I want. But once that I found, the autofocus pattern that I like, which was the small group, that was more tightly oriented toward the center of the frame, it worked quite well. It worked quite well. But there was a little playing around with the autofocus. Again, once I got it the way I wanted, it did work well. ISO 25,600 is the top. And you also have 9 frames per second continuous shooting. Both of those areas were very satisfactory to me. Bluetooth LE and Wi-Fi connectivity. And you can do that thing because it does have Bluetooth LE where it's talking to your smartphone or your iPad or whatever you have with you continuously. And you can get location data more or less in real time. Sending images back and forth seem to work well. It wants both the Bluetooth and the Wi-Fi connected to really operate smoothly. And once I got that set up, it wasn't bad at all. It worked quite well. You have three control dials, and very handy. And they have that control dial that I love, which is the ring around the shutter button. Now, by default, that isn't exposure compensation, as it often is on Olympus cameras. They wanted you, by default, to press a button, exposure compensation button, and then rotate a dial. So I dug around in the menus, and I found that I can reprogram that collar that's around the shutter button to be exposure compensation without having to push a button. I was much happier after I found that. But the control dials are terrific and very useful. I love them. It does have a built-in flash, which I appreciate. It is dust and splash resistant, which again is very nice, especially for a camera that's going to be out in the field. And it has one SD card slot, UHS 2. This is one area where you start to feel that it's a little different than a pro camera. It has one card slot, only 49 areas, only 49 for the AF system. You know, some of those things, you know, you feel, okay, so this is definitely an enthusiast camera and not a pro camera. I don't lose a lot of sleep over one card slot as long as I have a camera that has two card slots, which I do. I have the EM1 Mark II. So when I was shooting with this for the past month, the one card slot was not a problem at all. So, you know, those are the basic things with this camera, the basic overview. I have to tell you that even though it's not a petite camera in terms of its size, the weight on it is really nice. It's not too heavy at all. When I lift it up, it feels lighter than I thought it would be, if you know what I mean. And the grip is super comfortable. I love the grip. It's a little bit of an oversized grip, and the way that it's textured and everything, it feels great. When I was shooting with the larger 40 to 150 millimeter lens, it was very comfortable. I shot for about 4 hours with it. When I shot with the lighter lenses, the lens that I left on there is the Panasonic 20 millimeter F1.7, which is one of my favorite lenses. It's terrific on there. So it just feels really good in the hand. It's very comfortable. It's fairly easy to pack. It doesn't draw a lot of attention out in the field, which I appreciated. I managed to get it into a college graduation ceremony that did not allow pro cameras. I put a smaller 35 to 100 millimeter Panasonic 35 to 100 millimeter on that little 2-inch job that I love so much. Put that on there, and no one gave me a second look at all. I was just like another dad with, you know, his camera kind of thing, even though I got killer shots at that ceremony with this camera and with that lens. Alrighty, so it is a good camera. It is a good camera. Oh, by the way, well, we'll get into my five things. Let's do that. Let's get into the five things that I really like about. These are the good things. Now let's get into the really good things. All right, first really good thing. High quality image files. When I started processing the RAW files, the RW2 files in Adobe Lightroom, and at the time, Lightroom was the only app that I could find that could process those RAW files. Capture One wasn't ready for them yet. Photos wasn't ready for them yet. I don't believe Luminar was ready for them yet, but Lightroom could. So that was great news. And when the first batch of RW2s came up on my screen in Lightroom, I was just going, these look really nice. Really nice. Good color. Nice sharpness. Excellent tonality. They felt very much like photographs, if you know what I mean. They, you know, they had that pleasing sort of artistic photograph look to them. Excellent character is the way that I think I would say it. And I'm definitely putting this on my list of five things that I really like. The, you know, image quality is a big deal, and image quality can come across in a number of ways to different people. Some people, it's just all about sharpness. You know, that's what image quality is to them. And this camera is plenty sharp depending on the lens that you put on it. But for me, image quality is all about how the overall image looks. How does it render color? you know, how is it the dynamic range, the tonality, you know, of course, how is the, you know, the detail rendering, all that stuff to me. And in this camera, I just felt like it was very good in all those categories, so much so that image quality made my five favorite features list here. In fact, it's the number one. Second favorite feature, and I love this feature on this camera, which is the L monochrome D. And so that is, you know, you have picture styles to choose from, just like we do on practically every mirrorless camera. And this one has a regular monochrome, and it has, I believe, an L monochrome, and then it has L monochrome D, which isn't on the G85, but it is on the G95, this camera. And if you like black and white photography, I think you'll love L monochrome D on this G95. It's gorgeous. And if you're capturing RAW plus JPEGs, you know, of course, the RAW will be in color, and it'll be the RAW file, and then the JPEG will be the L monochrome D file. I'm guessing that you'll very seldom go to the RAW files unless you need a color rendering, because that particular picture style is just absolutely beautiful. It compares quite favorably to the black and white picture style that you can set up on the Pen F, and also on Fuji cameras that has the Acros film simulation. I mean, it is really good. Bold blacks, a little bit more contrast, just gorgeous. So pretty that, in fact, it made my list of five things. And I have a hard time when I'm shooting with this G95 pulling it off L monochrome D. The only time that I do is when I want to see the image in color instead of black and white, because when you're looking through the electronic viewfinder or on the LCD, you'll see it in black and white when it's in this picture style. However, you still get the color raw. But yeah, I had to make myself take it out of that mode. It's really very lovely. Number three, and oh my gosh, this was so nice to see. They have the perfect location for the microphone port. And anyone that's shot with an Olympus EM5 Mark II or a Pen F or any of those cameras where the microphone port is right where the LCD swings out, right? The articulated LCD. And you can't position the LCD the way that you want, you know, because the jack is going into the port right where it wants to swing around. What Panasonic did with this camera is just lovely. They moved the microphone port up to the top left corner of the camera. It's out of the way of the articulated LCD. It doesn't interfere at all with the plugged-in microphone. And at the same time, it's closer to the hot shoe, so that if you're putting a shotgun mic in your hot shoe, then, you know, it only has to plug in right up there in the upper left-hand corner, which keeps that cord out of the way when you're working. Just, oh, please, everyone else do this, okay? And by the way, this camera has both the microphone port placed in the right location, and it also has the headphone port. Now, the headphone port is in the standard location on the side of the camera, not quite as cool, but having the mic port up there is fine. And a lot of the shotgun mics, of course, you can monitor the headphone, you know, from the mic itself. It'll have an output port there. So then you should be in pretty good shape if you have that kind of mic. But yay, everyone else, take note of where Panasonic put this mic port. It was absolutely lovely and so logical. Okay, number four, excellent creative tools. I mean, this is something that I think we're becoming very spoiled with mirrorless cameras in general, having just all these wonderful features built into the camera so that if you want to play, you've got lots to play with. The in-camera HDR is quite good. I had a lot of fun playing with it, and you have different settings. You can have one-stop brackets or two-stop brackets or three-stop brackets, and the final rendering was excellent. I really liked it a lot. It was better than many that I've seen on competing brands. There's 4K photo, which is just a blast, right? You know, you can just shoot at 30 frames per second and then pick the shot you want, and you got plenty of resolution. Multiple exposure, time lapse, panorama, focus stacking, and it has some serious in-camera RAW processing. So in other words, if you're shooting RAW only, if you're not shooting RAW plus JPEG, and you want to output a JPEG from the camera, you can do that. But not only can you do that, you can adjust, boy, just about everything, really. Everything from color, contrast, you know, shadow, sharpening, you know, which picture mode it's in, all that kind of stuff can be adjusted right there in the camera and then output a JPEG onto the memory card. And then, of course, then you can just send it to your smartphone or to your tablet or whatever from the camera via Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. So that really wonderful in-camera RAW processing is actually quite useful. And, you know, you can output one file many different ways if you want to play with it. So you can output a monochrome, you can output a vivid color, you can output a portrait coloring. You know, you can do all this sort of stuff. It's a lot of fun and it's very easy and it's quite good. Then on top of all that, Panasonic introduces Live View Composite with this model. Olympus shooters will recognize this right away. It allows you to do these long exposures where they build up on the screen. You stop, you know, when it looks good. This is now on this camera as well. So there's lots of good stuff here for the creative photographer. I thought they did an excellent job of giving us options of, you know, things, creative things to play with when using the G95. And finally, number five, and this might not seem like a biggie, but it has become more important to me as time goes on. I can charge the battery in the camera either via USB directly plugged into the camera, or I can pull the battery out of the camera and charge it in the included separate battery charger. So you have both. And, you know, a lot of times with cameras that have USB charging, which again, I wish all of our mirrorless cameras included USB charging, because sometimes it's just so convenient to be able to go that route. All you need is a little cable and a hot USB port anywhere. And, you know, it could be just like a little brick charger or whatever, and you can charge your camera on the go. So I love in-camera USB charging, but a lot of times when they give us that, they don't give us the separate charger, and you have to buy that separately. What Panasonic has done with the G95 is we get the built-in USB charging and we get the separate charger so that you can go whichever way that you want. And I truly appreciate that. And believe it or not, most of the time I was just plugging the camera into USB. I was on the go a lot with this camera. I was traveling a lot and it was just the easier way to go. And I really appreciated it. And the battery itself, by the way, since we're talking about that area, I thought it was good. I wouldn't say that it was great, but I thought it was good. Now, there's a lot of stuff going on that's pulling battery juice, and it's a fairly substantial battery. And it did get me through the day most of the time, but it was a little nerve-wracking sometimes near the end of the day. And since this camera's a loner for me, I only had the one battery. So I probably would recommend a second battery if you're serious about this camera and if you're going to travel with it, which is a great travel camera, and I would recommend it for travel. But I would recommend a second battery. But anyway, so my fifth thing is USB charging and included separate battery charger. Very nice touch and very well done. Okay, how about the couple things that I didn't like? Well, there certainly were two that really jumped out at me. And the first one is that the G95, at least here in the US, is only available with bundled Lumix G Vario 12 to 60 millimeter f3.5 to 5.6 zoom. And that price is $1,200 for both of those together. It's a lovely zoom, the 12 to 60, f3.5 to 5.6, not very fast. And it's a little bit bigger than I like to carry for my everyday zoom, for sure. For me, it's not a lens I'm interested in. I have other lenses that I want to use on this camera, and this isn't one of them, to be honest with you. So it's sort of a bummer that having to buy that lens, which I'm sure raises the price $200 to $300 for this camera. I feel like I should be able to get this body for around $950 just with the body alone, instead of having to spend $1,200 for the lens and the camera. And that's a turnoff to me. I mean, that difference, you know, can be the difference in whether I purchase it or not. I read that in some other markets, they might be offering just the camera alone. And in that case, you know, I would be much happier and I would remove this complaint. But for me here in the U.S., having to buy those two together, real turnoff. I'm not happy about that $1,200 price tag at all for this camera. It feels expensive because I'm not going to be using the lens. Second, even though this camera is touted as a robust hybrid camera, on the 4K video, it has a crop of 1.25, which I don't understand why they did that, you know, on the 4K video. So what that means is if you're shooting with this 12 to 60 millimeter lens that you have, let's say that you're shooting at 12 millimeters, which is as wide as it would go, with the crop factor at 4K, the most width you can get is about 30 millimeters, right? Because you have the 12 millimeters. So first of all, you have the two crop factor. So that takes it to 24. And then you add 1.25 crop factor, and that brings it up to about 30 millimeters, if I'm doing my math right. 30 millimeters is not that wide for your widest angle, especially in cinematography. You know, when you're working with 16:9, and sometimes you want those lovely big establishing shots that are nice and wide, and being limited to 30 millimeter with a 12 millimeter lens. So now you really got to go something that's a bit more exotic that you probably wouldn't carry with you normally. It would make much more sense not to have that crop factor. And then that 12 millimeters, a 24 millimeter, which is much nicer than 30 millimeters at the widest end. I did some reading on, you know, why the heck do people think they did this? And it feels like that it could be lack of processing power is the reason why they have that crop factor in there. But it just seems odd to me for a camera that includes so many video-friendly features. You know, the mic port in the right position, the headphones, V-Log, multiple formats, sound adjustments, you know, all that good stuff. Just having, you know, that crop factor on 4K just doesn't feel right. And for me, it was certainly a buzzkill. So what's the bottom line on this camera? Well, I think if you're a Panasonic shooter and you like Panasonic cameras, this is certainly a camera to look at, especially if my two complaints don't bother you. So if you're okay with the two complaints, then I have to tell you the rest of the camera is pretty darn good. And I think most Panasonic shooters, enthusiast shooters, would really enjoy it. For people that are more general Micro Four Thirds shooters, in other words, they use both Olympus and Panasonic gear and they interchange. For that group, I would recommend to wait and see what Olympus does with the OMD EM5 Mark III, which we know is around the corner. I would wait and see what that camera looks like before investing $1,200 in this camera, because first of all, I think you'll be able to get the EM5 Mark III, just the body alone. Second of all, that camera was the Mark II was an excellent video camera, HD video camera. It's one that I actually use when I want to shoot HD video, and it, with a lot of great video controls and so forth. And I think that the Mark III is going to be fantastic, especially if they get the microphone port in the right place. I'm going to cross my fingers on that. But I would like to see what the EM5 Mark III looks like before making a decision on the G95. I think you can save yourself some money. And who knows, you might like that feature set a bit better for what you're doing. So that's my recommendation. If you're a Panasonic shooter and you like Panasonic, this is certainly a camera to look for, if you don't mind my complaints. And if you're a Micro Four Thirds shooter, I would wait and see what the EM5 Mark III looks like before making my decision. New Nimble Photographer podcast is actually number 5 so far in the series. Musician George Shaw. Now, let me tell you a little bit about George, and then I'm going to play a clip from our interview because I think you'll enjoy it. As a young man, what George Shaw did was he flew from city to city for 2 years with a cassette recorder in his hand. And the question that he posed to each of these music professionals, and they were jazz musicians, that he interviewed was, how can music, and in particular improvisation, best be taught? He wanted to know, is it genetic, or is it environmental, or is it a little bit of each? You know, that was what he was after. And he was actually working on his PhD dissertation. This was his dissertation. So after studying their answers and writing a dissertation on this subject, George Shaw has applied what he's learned to teaching music, and he's been teaching music for quite a while, and he records music, he has a production company. He's a fascinating person. So the excerpt that I'm going to play for you right now is when he was first getting started with this dissertation, and he hadn't interviewed anyone yet. And, well, I'm going to let George take it from there.
I get to Wichita Jazz Festival. I rent a car. I have no ticket. I drive to the jazz festival. I'm standing out front. A taxi pulls up. A guy gets out. Now, I knew who it was. It was Joe Henderson, who's a famous saxophone player, because I'd seen this picture on album cover. He walks straight over to me out of the cab, and he says, "Hey, man, do you have $5? I said, "Yeah." He said, "Give it to that taxi driver. You got a ticket?" I said, "No." He said, "Give it to that taxi driver, grab my horn, and come go with me." So I go from no ticket, don't know anybody, to I'm now Joe Henderson's roadie, and I'm backstage.
Oh, gosh.
Literally, that's how it happened. That's literally how it happened. So, I mean, it's like, you know, people talk about right place, right time.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I guess there's something to that. But all I know is I happen to be standing there, I happen to recognize Joe, and I happen to have $5. You know,
that is something.
And so Joe gets me backstage, and then I meet a guy named Milt Hinton, who's a famous bass player. I asked him to help carry his amplifier. He says, "I'm a nice guy. When you come to New York, you can stay at my house." So I go from that to I'm at Milt's in his basement talking to Count Basie. And next thing I know, I'm at Carnegie Hall with Sarah Vaughan, Clark Terry, Dizzy Gillespie. All this happens within a matter of weeks.
Wow.
Literally weeks. It scared me to death.
But you just kept going, right? You just keep going, right? Right.
I never told anybody that I didn't know what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, because you know, if you think about it, as an experienced interviewer, as you know, you'd have everything all planned out. You know, what the theme is going to be. You know, you have a pattern that you're going to follow. Well, one of the first things I figured out about jazz guys is that they want to talk, and then when they talk to you, if they go down a road that you don't necessarily need, you just got to kind of go there until you can get what you need.
Exactly, exactly.
You know. So anyway, it was fun, and I was able to turn that into a degree.
You know, going back to our original thesis, after talking to these guys and gals, because you mentioned Sarah Vaughan and so forth also, what's your take on this? Is this something that you're born with? Is this something that you can learn, or is it a little bit of each?
It's a little bit of each, but a commonality. Everybody I talked to grew up, and there was music going all the time. They had some reference to music from an early age.
That makes sense.
There were people in the house singing. There were people playing music. The guy down the street played piano. On the way to school, they'd hear some guy playing saxophone. There was music all around them. And some of them had older siblings who were involved. Stuff that was just going on in their environment.
Now, if you haven't listened to this series of podcasts, the whole idea about them is that I interview artists from different disciplines. So, yes, photography, but I have an illustrator, I have a couple of musicians. And what I want to know is, you know, their view on art, especially being an artist in today's economy, and, you know, what that means to them, what success means to them. And I want to hear how they got from whatever was their beginnings to where they are now and how they view where they are now and where possibly they think their craft is going. All you have to do is, of course, click on any of the links in the show notes that I have here. You can listen to it on Apple Music. Just click on the link or go to Apple Music and search for The Nimble Photographer Podcast. You can get it on Google Play Music. And again, just search for The Nimble Photographer Podcast or, you know, wherever you listen to your podcast. You can moan about Adobe, but the company is making more money than ever. This is F-Stopper's article. I have the link in the show notes to the entire article. But those of you that use Lightroom and Photoshop, I thought you might be interested in this. Let me just read you a few paragraphs from the article. You may frequently hear complaints about Lightroom and Photoshop. Too buggy, too slow, too bloated, too expensive. But it doesn't seem to be putting a dent in Adobe's performance. In fact, it's quite the opposite. As the company announced last week, it has achieved record revenues for the second fiscal quarter of the year. As reported in a press release last week, Adobe generated $2.74 billion in the second quarter of 2019, a record for the company and a growth of 25% year over year. The success is attributed to, quote, the explosion of creativity across the globe, end quote, the need for companies to deliver, quote, engaging customer experiences, and their strong ecosystem of partners, okay? Many photographers have objected to the shift to subscription-based model, and given the complaints, you'd be forgiven for thinking that Lightroom is falling from favor in face of competition from Capture One and a growing assortment of alternatives such as Luminar and On One. Photoshop is also seeing strong challenges from Affinity Photo and Pixelmator Pro. But despite these anecdotal grievances, Adobe appears to be doing better than ever. So this is interesting to me in the sense that a company does something that they know is good for their business. They were pretty sure that when they went subscription-based that it was going to be good for the bottom line, and it certainly has turned out that way. And it wasn't so abhorrent to users that they actually left the ecosystem. I know some have left, but generally speaking, things are just rolling along. It appears that people have put up with the change for the most part, and that Adobe is making more money than ever. I have a few Virtual Camera Club updates. First of all, a big thanks to our Inner Circle members. Our Inner Circle members are the ones who keep this podcast on the air, who help fuel projects such as the Nimble Photographer Podcast, and who are an overall support system and camaraderie, I must add, for me and for other Inner Circle members. This is something that goes beyond, just helping keep the lights on. This is something that has far more heart to it. If you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member, all you have to do is click on the tile that's on every page of the Digital Story. Just look for the Patreon tile. That'll take you to our page there. You can take a look around and you can add your support if you are so moved, which I hope that you would just feel this warm glow of support come over you and click that button. At any rate, a big thanks to all of our Inner Circle members. I so appreciate your participation and support. Keep in mind that we have tiles for both B&H and Amazon on all the pages of the Digital Story. If you feel like you're going to make a purchase at either of these places, if you would just come to our site first, click on one of those tiles, they're in the second column, and then go over to the respective site. That helps support this site and it doesn't cost you any more. And again, we have tiles on there for both B&H and Amazon, and your purchases there help support this site when you go through our site first. And finally, a big thanks to our friends at Red River Paper. They are the folks that make the expansive list of printing surfaces, just about anything that you want and just about any size that you could want, and also all sorts of fun specialty items such as fine art print cards, plus the envelopes that go with them, plus the glassine sleeves. It goes on and on. You can get your ink there. You can learn about different printers there through their reviews. You can read the tutorials to learn how to do different things with your inkjet printer. Red River Paper is the one stop for the printing enthusiast. All you have to do is click on the tile that's on every page of the digital story. That'll take you to our landing page there. And they also have a wonderful Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the review of the Panasonic G95. I'm working on more goodies for next week. Make sure you come back and join me. Until then, have a fantastic week. Bye-bye now.